This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome once again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, this time for our 32nd episode. Today, we will look at an innovative system-level approach to initiating medical therapy for patients with osteoporotic fractures. As we all know, osteoporosis is undertreated, and this report may give us insight into how we can better serve these at-risk individuals. The paper we will review is a case series, and so comes with several intrinsic limitations that will need to be carefully considered, so we will do our usual detailed look at the methodology employed here. As you all know, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast. I work at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, as a general endocrinologist, medical director for our endocrinology clinics, and an associate director for our fellowship program. Back today as our regular contributor is Amal Shibley-Rahal from the University of Iowa in Iowa City. She is a master educator in endocrinology, currently serving as an associate dean for the Carver College of Medicine and as the lead endocrine educator for the internal medicine residency there, having also been the fellowship director in the recent past. Her clinical practice focuses on bone and calcium disorders with numerous publications in this field and in endocrinology in general. Our guest expert today comes to us from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Ann Kearns also specializes in calcium and bone disorders, directing the osteoporosis clinic at Mayo and writing and speaking extensively in this area. Importantly for us today, she leads efforts both at Mayo and nationally to improve systems of care for patients with osteoporosis, especially those who have suffered an osteoporotic fracture. So, as is obvious, the perfect pair of endocrinologists join me to unpack this article for us. As is also always the case, everything we discuss is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. For this episode, we look at inpatient zoledronic acid and integrated orthopedic and fracture liaison services improve osteoporosis treatment rates, which is a forthcoming article in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Wu Qiang Fan and Melissa Machado serve as the first authors on this paper, which comes to us from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. At this point, I will turn things over to Amal. She will highlight some of the key points that the authors make in their introduction. Along the way, both she and Anne will review some important aspects of the treatment of osteoporosis that will help us better understand this investigation. Amal?
Thank you, Chase. Osteoporosis is one of the most common conditions in aging people, and it leads to a high risk of fragility fractures, affecting more than 40% of women and up to 33% of men in their lifetime. After one fragility fracture, the risk of recurrent fractures increases fivefold in the first year and remains elevated approximately twofold higher for up to 10 years. Likewise, morbidity and mortality increase significantly after a fracture. In particular, after a hip fracture, there is an up to 30% increase in mortality in community-dwelling individuals, and up to a 55% increase in mortality in long-term facility residents. Although we now have many effective pharmacotherapies for osteoporosis with proven effectiveness in primary and secondary fracture prevention, less than 20% of patients with a fragility fracture are started on treatment. And here I would like to pose a question to Anne to give us a brief overview of treatment options and why they are so rarely used after a fracture.
Well, thank you, Amal. The blessing of osteoporosis is that we now have more treatment options than ever, and that can include oral bisphosphonates, of which there are three: alendronate, risedronate, and abandronate, or intravenous bisphosphonates, including zoledronic acid, as used in this study, or abandronate. More advanced therapies could include denosumab or bone anabolic agents such as teriparatide, abaloparatide, or the newest one, romosozumab. I think some of the barriers to treatment, especially in this population, is first of all, the negative press around some of the medications, and the lingering doubts patients have about the efficacy, as well as some of those same lingering doubts in treating practitioners, especially in primary care people or people who are less familiar with updates to negative reports on medications. That's, I think, the biggest barriers that we face. In the fracture population, it's often that they get lost in the shuffle, and we'll maybe touch on that a little bit more.
Thank you, Anne. Zoledronic acid is a particularly interesting drug in this setting, given its dosing schedule of 12 to 18 months, and the fact that it has been shown to decrease all-cause mortality by up to 28% after a hip fracture. This study reports the results of a fracture liaison service, commonly referred to as FLS, that collaborated with orthopedic surgery in order to identify, assess, and treat hospitalized patients with a fragility fracture. And I have a question to you about the different models of FLS. We know there are some based on inpatient and others on the outpatient treatment model, and briefly overview the data on their effectiveness.
Well, I think that this model of care is the accepted gold standard, that you have to capture the fracture, so to speak, and that is one of the slogans for an orthopedic society that's working in conjunction with primary care and endocrine specialists to really reduce the risk of additional fractures. So one way to do that is in the inpatient setting, as was done in the study we're going to discuss. Sometimes the patients are not in a receptive frame of mind. They're in pain. They're not mentally as alert right after a major operation. Their family is deep in the decision of where they will go from there, whether they go home. So sometimes it's not the right setting to address all the issues. In the study of zoledronic acid that you referred, that medication was given as an outpatient at about 6 to 8 weeks after the fracture. Other practices do a similar outpatient follow-up to initiate treatment. I think both have been shown to be effective in increasing the use of medications and even in the best studies to reduce the risk of fractures. So I think it's beyond us needing to prove in a specific patient population that the medications work or that the model works. It often gets tripped up on how to implement the model because it's very difficult.
Thanks to you both for setting us up nicely there, in particular, and talking about where the trip up there is, how to implement that model. So that's what we're going to look at here and see if we can gain any helpful information on how to implement such a model here. So first of all, what we're going to do, like we normally do, is think about the study design overall. And in looking at this, I would describe what the authors do here, the report that they use is structured as a case series. So we have not frequently looked at case series, so probably helpful to describe that just a little bit. It is an observational design, and it simply reports a series of patients, a series of cases, and described how those patients presented, what was done to them, and then what the outcome was. The big difference in either case reports, so single cases or case series, which it would be multiple, is that there is not a control group. So that's the huge limitation to this type of a report. And thinking about that in general, if you are looking at an intervention, a surgery, a medication, whatever it is, you want to know what the result of that is in comparison to either some accepted standard of care or not doing anything at all. So you need to know, well, what if we hadn't done whatever this report looks at doing? And the problem with the case series is that you don't know. You don't have another group. You don't have that control group to where they were treated differently or not treated at all. And so that remains a huge question with any type of a case series. There's a few ways that authors can try to address that. None of them are perfect, but they at least help. One of them is simply to survey literature that's out there and say other reports have been published on different treatment methods, on not treating at all, and this is what typically happens. The obvious issue there is that the specific patient population that authors would be reporting on are almost certainly going to be different and often significantly different from whatever else is out there in the literature. And so there's always a question of, well, is it the difference in the populations or some other sort of care that they're receiving? That's the driver here. A little bit better, though still with issues, are what are often called historical controls. Now, the authors here don't use that term. I'm glad that they don't, because I think it can be confusing because they're not truly controls. But the idea behind historical controls is that you look at whatever your group did before. So if you're looking at your own practice and saying, since we started doing X, this is what's happened. One thing that you can do is say, but before we started to do that, this is how things did. And that gets a little bit closer because you're likely looking at a more similar patient population to what's being examined now. The challenge, though, with that and why these wouldn't truly be considered controls is that many things change over time. So you're looking at likely one or a group of things and hoping to figure out whether that was what drove a difference in an outcome. But there can also be other changes that occur over time. So different reports this works differently for, but those are in general how you can approach a case series not having a control group. So we'll think about that. The authors do some of this here. So we'll think about how they do that and how helpful that is to try to understand the likely impact of what they report here. Okay, so now back to this study. So this report, as Amal mentioned already, this looks at the fracture liaison service at the MGH. They started their fracture liaison service back in February of 2016. They had a couple of phases of how they implemented this fracture liaison service. So initially from February of 2016 up to the end of that calendar year, 2016, as they were piloting this, they really just focused on hip fragility fractures only. They worked out some of their processes. So at the beginning of 2017, January 2017, they were able to do any fragility fracture. And their data collection, at least what's reported here, goes all the way up through the end of 2019. December 2019. So that's the data that we're looking at initially, just hip fractures, but then most of this, all types of fragility fractures. So a bit more of the particulars as the authors describe their fracture liaison service. So first of all, this was run by a physician assistant. And some of the terminology that they use here is describing this individual as a fracture liaison service navigator. And then that person worked alongside an endocrinology faculty member, but that was a rotating person. So that was not the same person. That changed periodically. And the authors describe what they do as having six functions, and then also several processes that we do. So I will stick with their terminology because I think it's helpful to understand what they report. So first of all, the six functions that this fracture liaison service had is described by the author. So first of all, is case finding, so identifying who has had a fragility fracture. Second is the initial evaluation, that inpatient evaluation. Third is treatment initiation. The fourth function is education, and that's patient and family or caregiver education. Fifth is coordination of care to the outpatient setting, that transition of care. And then finally, sixth is communication with a primary care provider. And so I would say before we move on with those functions is that there's a little bit of variability in how the authors report this. I do think it's helpful how they describe the six functions of the fracture liaison service. But when we get to the results that Amal's going to walk us through, we only get information about some of these. So it's a little bit hard to know how well this system functioned with each of these six functions. So some of them, we only get partial information. So for example, the case finding, we get some information. The treatment initiation, we get some. But for other aspects of it, we get very little at all. So the education, for example, we don't really understand a whole lot out of how of the results around that. So something that we'll keep in mind, Amal's going to walk us through some of that. So we'll keep that paradigm as the authors have laid that out there, those six functions. So now the actual processes, how they went about carrying out those functions as described by the authors. So first of all, the way that they described it is that a consultation to the fracture liaison service was triggered by an embedded order in the orthopedic mission set. And whenever that order set was used, that's what triggered the consultation. Also, as a part of that order set, there were several basic labs that were default, and that was a vitamin D, a PTH, a BMP, a TSH, a FOS level, albumin, and also an ALK-FOS. And then part of the work that the fracture liaison service, specifically the navigator, did was scheduled outpatient follow-up that was supposed to coordinate whenever the orthopedic follow-up was scheduled. And that was pretty typically 6 weeks after the hospitalization, though there was an option to see a local provider instead if the situation demanded that that was the most appropriate. And then the next process that's listed here, and I'm going to quote the initial part of it because I think it's helpful for us to tease apart here in just a second. So I say, quote, for those patients deemed to be at risk of failing timely outpatient follow-up, end quote, treatment with zoledronate could be administered inpatient. And then finally, as a process, all patients were started on vitamin D and calcium supplementation. So now that I've outlined some of the functions and the processes here, I want us to stop and think about that a little bit more before we get to the results. And I'll ask you guys, Amal and Ann, to comment on that, just on a couple different things. So one thing that I would say is we don't really know for sure, in particular, how many patients were missed here. So we talk about a function of the case finding, and Amal's going to tell us how many cases were seen, but we don't necessarily understand how many cases were potentially missed with this. And then the other thing that I was curious about, particularly looking at this from the lens of, well, maybe I might want to implement something like this. How exactly would I do this? Was this decision about deciding whether or not to treat somebody inpatient. It was decided on whether they were thought to be at high risk for failing outpatient follow-up, but exactly what went into that decision was a little bit unclear. So I'd be interested, and Ann, maybe we can start with you. Any comments that you might have on more information that we might want about the function or the processes here?
First of all, I would say that coordinating with orthopedic care is definitely a good idea, because those are where the patients often enter the system, not all fractures. So we are even looking at a very limited set of fragility fractures, because they're only looking at ones that were inpatient. The vast majority of proximal humerus, other fragility fractures are outpatient. So we're looking at a very select population to begin with, those that needed hospitalization. I agree that it's not clear to me when they say it's embedded in the orthopedic admission order, was it a default? Or did the orthopedic team have to think about it and choose it? If they had to think about it and choose it, there's a higher likelihood that there would be incomplete capture. I don't know why they didn't use diagnosis codes. Epic can gather all the diagnosis codes for hospitalized patients in their system in this time period with a hip fracture or a whatever diagnosis code, and that could have been their true denominator. Instead, they relied on those that they were asked to see. And that's probably because their real goal is, if they see them, are they efficient in getting them on medication? So they're not looking at the pre-steps up to where they're consulted. It's really just from there on. And I think that's a limitation, but it does give us some insights. Amal, do you have other thoughts?
I agree with your assessment, Anne, is that I'm not really sure how that embedded order works. Does it default to every admission? Or do they have to click yes or no? Can they opt out? Does it ask a preemptive question saying, is this a fragility fracture? And then if you answer yes to that, then it becomes a default. It would have been very helpful to know how that choice operates. And the question then becomes is, how many are we missing and how many false positives are they capturing? You know, if it is every admission that gets this by default, are they getting called on every orthopedic admission? So yes, potentially, depending on how it is designed, which we don't know, we could have missed some of those cases.
Good. So at this point, we're going to move on to the results section. Amal's going to walk us through this. We have a bit of an understanding about how this was set up. So we'll begin to try to assess how effective that is. And again, I think it'll be helpful. We may come back to this, of those different functions, those six functions, as the authors describe, of their fracture liaison service. And we can try to put these results into those different categories of what is this telling us about each of those functions. But we'll come back to that later. Amal's going to walk us through the results at this point. Amal?
I will start with describing the baseline characteristics. A total of 1,240 inpatient consultations for fragility fractures were performed by this FLS service between February 1st, 2016 and December 30, 2019. 75% of these patients were women, and 50% of them were above 80 years of age. 60% of all those fractures were hip fractures, with femoral neck and intertrochanteric fractures accounting for the majority of those. So it goes back to Anne's point, is that we are capturing a select group of fragility fracture primarily. Around 39% of all patients had suffered one or more prior fragility fracture prior before this index hospitalization. 11% of patients with a prior fragility fracture were on osteoporosis therapy at the time of presentation. And that again supports what we previously mentioned in terms of the fact that very few patients with a fragility fracture are treated for osteoporosis. 6% of patients without prior fragility fracture were on therapy at the time of admission for this index hospitalization. So if we look at the full sample of 1,240 patients, 8% in total, were on therapy at the time of this index consultation or hospitalization. Now I will move to the follow-up on those cases. Of the initial 1,240 patients with fragility fractures, treatment was not medically indicated in 57, and 123 patients died. This left a sample of 1,060 patients who were deemed eligible for treatment. Of those, 471 had an unknown treatment status, either because their follow-up had not occurred at the time when the study was performed, or because their follow-up was arranged outside the MGH healthcare system. This leaves us with 589 patients who were eligible for treatment and who had a known treatment status. 177, or 30% of those, refused treatment, and 412, or 70% of those, received treatment. This included initiation of new therapy in 346 patients and continued or adjusted therapy in 66. Of the 412 patients who received therapy, 26% received inpatient zoledronic acid. I would like to note that 575 patients were scheduled for a combined orthopedic and FLS postoperative outpatient visit. About 53% of these patients, i.e. 307 patients, kept the FLS appointment. Now, moving on to the outcomes of the study. We will focus on the patients where follow-up was available and treatment was indicated. So among those who were eligible for treatment and where we know what their follow-up was, 70% achieved treatment and 26% of the treated patients received zoledronic acid during hospitalization. Because there was a theoretical concern that zoledronic acid may prolong the length of stay due to an acute phase reaction, or that it may be associated with poor fracture healing, the length of stay and the 30-day readmission rates were compared between the patients who received inpatient zoledronic acid and those who declined treatment. These analyses showed no difference in length of stay and 30-day readmission rates between the two groups. And there was no difference in these outcomes when they were analyzed by sex.
And I might chime in here just to say, when I was looking at that, trying to think about how that might affect it, because the patients who were given zoledronic acid or zoledronate inpatient, that was a select group of people. And so anytime you've got an intervention that's really given intentionally to just some group of people, you really have to start worrying about how a bias might affect there. And as I was thinking about this, and you could probably argue this different ways, I actually thought that probably that would be a selection bias actually in favor of it being more likely that those folks would have a longer length of stay or be at a higher readmission risk. Again, we don't really know because we don't know what drove that decision to give zoledronate on the inpatient side. But if you're at least to imagine, I think it's plausible that whatever was driving that decision would also be factors likely to be associated with, if not a prolonged length of stay, then at least a higher 30-day readmission rate. So I thought it was at least encouraging. It's a case series, so we don't know these things for sure, but it's at least encouraging that despite that possible selection bias, we still didn't see a difference there. So I thought that was a nice feature that the authors included that.
Yeah, I agree with that, Chase. And unfortunately, the authors do not exactly describe how they selected that high-risk population, but they hint at it a little bit by indicating that a large portion of their patients were in the very old category. And so we probably can assume that many of these people who were selected for inpatient zoledronic acid were selected because of their advanced age, which again, inherently could put them at a higher risk for a longer length of stay or a higher chance of readmission. So I agree, you know, despite the embedded selection bias, it's interesting that we don't see an increase in the length of stay or readmission rates.
I think that's the main point that this study can for sure tell us, given the differences that we don't know about the selection of patients. I think there's a couple other things that are worth mentioning. It's not clear to me how long they followed people. Did they follow them for 30 days after the initial consultation, 60 days, or is this a longitudinal clinic? because if only 123 out of the 1,240 patients died, that's very low. Okay, 25% of hip fracture patients die within the first year. Were those deaths in hospital? Were those 30-day mortality? Or are they just selecting for a relatively healthy population, but only 57 did they think were medically not suitable for treatment? So I think there's some questions that I have about their patient population in that regard. And if we look at who they felt were eligible, although they claim 70%, it's 412 out of 1,240. So it's, I think how they're calculating is a little hard to know. And I don't know how the follow-up really went. Regarding the treatment, the study that was done with zoledronic acid gave it at 6 to 8 weeks. We know that bisphosphonates go to the area of highest bone turnover, which would be the site of fracture healing. You know, again, this is where follow-up comes up. At 30 days, you can't, no orthopedic, having done this for a long time, no orthopedic surgeon can tell you whether there's non-union or delayed healing of the fracture. So I think the remaining question they didn't answer and can't answer, maybe because they didn't follow up in that way, is does zoledronic acid at the acute time of fracture impair fracture healing because that medication concentrates in the repair area? We don't know. Second question is, does that limit the efficacy for further fracture prevention? We don't really know. There's a lot of questions about their follow-up that I think their claims can't quite support. That I do agree it can support that there was an acute phase problem, that there was not an acute phase problem that lengthened stay or readmission rate given the selected population, but there's still some remaining questions.
I agree. And actually, Anne, you brought up a very important point about all the patients who we don't know what happened to them, all the patients who have an unknown follow-up. So that bothered me a little bit when I was reading this study. So I did some calculations on my own. The results indicate that 471 patients were deemed eligible for treatment, but had an unknown treatment status. And the study did not include them when they estimated treatment rates. So I did a couple of manipulations here. I assumed that all of these 471 patients did indeed somehow end up receiving treatment for osteoporosis. So under that assumption, 83% of all of the patients who were eligible for treatment, once we've excluded the ones who died and the ones who were not deemed eligible, that leaves us with 83% of all patients receiving therapy. But that's not realistic. It's unlikely that all of those patients did end up receiving treatment. So I went to the other sort of therapeutic extreme and I said, well, what if none of these 471 patients received treatment for osteoporosis? And I still factored them into the denominator. And I came up with 40% of all eligible patients in that case would have received therapy, which is much less than the 70% treatment rates reported in the study. However, it's still more than what we know about the general populations of patients with fragility fractures, where 10 to 20, maybe up to 30% maximum end up receiving treatment in the absence of a fracture liaison service intervention. So for these calculations, obviously, I assume the two treatment extremes, if all of them were treated or if none of them were treated, the truth is probably somewhere in between. And the problem is we don't know how many were treated. So I'm wondering what you guys think would have been the best way of reporting on this unknown group.
Well, I guess I wonder what they mean by they had an unknown treatment status, meaning if you ask the patient, they don't know.
They defined it a little bit earlier in that their follow-up had not happened yet when they set out to do their data analysis, or the patient was basically lost from their system. So they probably went to their primary care physician who was outside the MGH healthcare system, and they just did not have any information on the patient.
Well, I think that they could have extended their study period if they were just waiting for follow-up in their system. Second, third, Epic is the most used medical record. You could look to see if they were had fought their primary care in another center in Epic. So you could have gathered more information. it is troubling. And I think that's why I think their results are encouraging, but there's more work to be done. And
And Amal, I agree with you. I think if we infer what we know from other reports of how infrequently these folks are treated, the number was probably higher than 40%, but it probably wasn't very much higher than 40%. So if you wanted to choose one, that's going to be almost certainly a lot closer to the reality. But again, it's always hard to know what to do with the unknown information in your reports and how to do that.
I agree. Before I turn it back to you, Chase, I would like to again make a note of the 575 patients who were scheduled to receive outpatient orthopedic FLS follow-up, where only 53% kept that appointment. The rest of them either canceled that outpatient follow-up with the FLS service or no-showed. And I think this is an important point to keep in mind. We'll come back to explore this point a little bit toward the end.
Good. Thank you, Amal. And I think that nicely sets things up and helps us understand a lot of information and how to be thinking about that. So now what we're going to do is transition into the discussion. And I'm going to walk through it as the authors do. So they lay a lot of groundwork before they get to summarizing their results and getting into potential implications of their findings. So first of all, they lay a little bit of context here. So they point out, we've mentioned this before, but after a fragility fracture, treatment is pretty uncommon. So in the literature, it's somewhere 10 to 28%, depending on where you're looking. Now, this is where they pull in their historical control. They don't use this terminology, but essentially what it is. So they report that in the year prior to starting their fracture liaison service at MGH, only 6% of patients were started on treatment after they'd had a hip fracture, and only 40% of patients saw their primary care provider within 6 months of having had a fracture. So they suggest that their rates were also really, really low and in line with what's reported in the rest of the literature. And as been pointed out already, that at least in this data set, only about 11.5% of people who had a fracture before were on treatment at the time when they came in for their current fracture. I'm all pointed that out. So again, suggests that even after you've had a fracture, you're not very likely to get treated. The authors then start talking a little bit about potential reasons for this or explanations for why there is such a low treatment frequency, particularly in this group. So a few different that they suggest, some of them we've talked about already. So worry about side effects, and then that could be side effects that patients are worried about or potentially even providers are worried about. Osteonecrosis of the jaw and atypical femur fracture being the two most likely drivers of that. Clinical inertia was also suggested. A lack of knowledge, and that was the way they described that, primarily around providers not knowing that treatment was indicated after a fracture. And then finally, something that would be more patient-specific is difficulty in maintaining treatment for asymptomatic conditions. So, Anne, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. You think about this a lot. You talk to a lot of people. You know the literature here. You see a lot of these patients. So what are your thoughts on these causes? What do we know about what, if any, is the real big contributor to this issue?
I'd like to lump it into three baskets. There's patient factors, the provider factors, and their processes and system factors. So when we look at the patient factors, certainly there's fear about medications. There's not wanting to take additional pills. And that's where having options that are parenteral and very infrequently giving, such as zoledronic acid, really are a nice way to do that. Also, that can ensure follow-up because you get notified as a provider that they're due for their medication and you can reach out and have a system there. There is to give the primary care team a break here. They're dealing with 50 problems. That's not the high priority for the patient. The patient's in there with constipation, or where are they going in the nursing home, or the provider's worried about their edema. Do they have a DVT from this recent, you know? So it does get lost in the shuffle. So I think, to be fair, it's just that there is, to some extent, I think the provider factors. Yes, there might be a lack of knowledge. It might be more around how to talk to patients, not about what to do, but how to talk to patients in a way that can engage them in wanting to take a medication or getting on board. But I think there is just the overburden of all the problems and all the issues. Remember, 50% of these patients are over 80. Okay, they're usually on multiple medications, have multiple issues, want to know if they can drive now, all kinds of things. As pointed out, there is a difficulty in maintaining treatment, and that is assuming you get the treatment initiated. And what they don't talk about in here, but an area that I have been growing in interest and have done a recent study on, not yet submitted for publication, is the transition in care. So from an FLS program back to primary care, an FLS program cannot manage everyone with osteoporosis even after a fracture, no more than a cardiologist can manage everyone who's had an MI after an event. So there has to be a good process for defining the plan, handing it off, telling the primary care, these are the things to do. This is when you need to loop me back in. The study wasn't designed to that, but that's another step in the process to get patients on treatment and maintain them on treatment.
Thanks. So after that, the authors then talk a little bit about this inpatient administration of zoledronate. So Amal mentioned this already. The authors mentioned it again. It is about this data around zoledronate that there is data supporting fracture reduction, even with a single dose, and also a mortality reduction. And they point out that there is inconsistency in the recommendations regarding treatment with an anti-resorptive in the immediate post-fracture setting. Anne walked us through the pathophys of that, of why that would potentially be concerning for a variety of reasons. And the authors point out that it's unclear if that's an okay thing to do or not. Though they do point out something that we've agreed with already is that the finding of an unchanged length of stay and 30-day readmission, whether you got the zoledronate inpatient or not, is definitely encouraging. So then after they've laid all that groundwork, now the authors get to their summary, which they point out is that that this approach that we've talked about already with this fracture liaison service led to an increased pharmacotherapy rate, at least among eligible patients with a verifiable treatment status of 70%. We've gone back and forth on this already and whether that's really the right way to describe it, but at least as specifically defined here, eligible patients with a verified treatment status, it is 70%. But I think if you factor in all the people who don't have an unknown treatment status or likely untreated, that number is certainly going to be lower than that. The authors then go on to talk about unaddressed treatment gaps. A few of those we've alluded to already, but I think are worth going through because it's helpful to think about. One of them is the way they describe it as an age-related disparity. So most of these patients are above the age of 80, and there does seem to be a decreased likelihood of treatment the older these individuals are. And they point out, and Amal mentioned this already in her results, is that the inpatient administration of zoledronate helps that at least some. It doesn't resolve that gap, but it at least starts helping with that. Another that they point out is that of those individuals who were known to not be treated, so there's not an unknown group here, it's that we know they didn't get treated, that nearly half of those individuals declined due to concern for side effects. And I thought we could pause here just to point out, we know this, I think, both from taking care of patients and what's out there in the literature. I continue to find this very, very striking. This isn't an asymptomatic group. These were not individuals who had osteoporosis identified on a screening exam and are trying to decide whether they should take a medicine for something that hasn't caused them any problems. These are the people who got admitted to the hospital because they had a fragility fracture that was that bad. And still in this group who is currently suffering, if I can use that word, from a fracture, about half of them are so concerned about side effects that when they decline to take the medicine, that's the reason for why they're declining, because they're worried about side effects. So maybe let Amal or Anne comment on anything about that or their experience with this or just thoughts in general about this real challenge that we have about trying to address these side effects and the perceived likelihood for what's in reality appears to be a very unlikely event.
Well, I could say a couple things first. The second hat that I wear is a quality improvement and quality and process specialist. And I think my biggest concern with this paper or this report is that there's not enough in here for someone else, as you mentioned, to take this and run and implement it in their system. If zoledronic acid is the answer, why didn't they give it to all? Why was it limited to just 26% of the inpatients? Why wouldn't you just say, we're going to do this to everyone who wasn't on treatment or who needed a step up in treatment? So I think that is kind of a puzzling thing. And where the decisions were made and how they were made is really lacking. I think sometimes we have to learn how to talk to patients about the problem. And there isn't enough in here for me to judge how they approached it. But I will just tell you from the perspective of my mother, who is in this age group, that talking to her about mortality does not move her, okay? But talking to her about lack of independence and disability and further restriction in the things that she likes to do and wants to do, which we could put under a quality of life, moves people. And I don't know how they approached it. And what we often see about the zoledronic acid paper is the mortality, but we forget that in that same study, they showed significant reductions in long-term care use and in decrementing quality of life. So those, I think, are probably as meaningful. And physicians, we all care about mortality, but if we're patient-centered, we'll be talking about what matters to the patients. And there are studies showing that elderly patients' mortality isn't the number one concern.
I agree with Anne, particularly in this older patient group, maintaining physical ability and function is a very important point to talk about. And the different ways that that gets harmed from the index fracture or the recurrent fracture that could happen if the patient does not receive treatment should be a big focus of the discussion. I also find that, unfortunately, even this many years later, people still misunderstand the frequency or the amplitude of the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw and subtrochanteric fractures, including sometimes among physicians. But in this case, you know, when you have a fracture liaison service, I think this is a particularly capable group who are well educated on fracture and treatment of fracture and osteoporosis, treatment of osteoporosis, that they should be able to spend enough time with the patient to debunk some of these myths around osteonecrosis of the jaw and subtrochanteric fractures and address the false impression that people have regarding their frequency. Because I often, patients tell me, I don't know why you want to put me on a treatment that's going to disintegrate my jaw and break my leg. And when we talk about the real risk of that versus the real risk of another fracture from osteoporosis, then that puts things in context and it becomes not as hard to talk patients into accepting treatment. So back to your initial point, when you discussed the methods, Chase, you know, the piece on education that really we don't see in this paper, how they addressed patient education. I would have been very interested in seeing how they address that piece of education with the patient.
So back here to the author's list of these unaddressed treatment gaps that they're discussing. So one final thing, and we talked about this already, but they do point out that that transition to the outpatient setting does remain a challenge. Amal mentioned that, Anne mentioned that, and they say specifically that 38% of the individuals that they saw in the inpatient setting had an unknown treatment status because follow-up was arranged outside of their own healthcare system. So challenging to know what happened there. As far as limitations go, so we've talked about a few already. The authors do a good job of pointing out several as well. So they mention that it is a single center and it's a relatively small sample size. I might editorialize it. Still a good group of people for what we're looking at here. The authors do point out that they lack lab values here. So that was not information that they collected. So there's a lot of unknowns there. And then finally, that there is a lack of clinical outcomes. Anne mentioned some concerns there already about giving inpatient zoledronic acid. Do we have any worry about fracture healing and without the clinical outcomes? The authors acknowledge that there is some limitations in understanding the impact of what they've done here. So finally, the authors conclude that a fracture liaison service with inpatient zoledronate increased appropriate treatment from around 8 to 11% to 70%, again, among eligible patients with a verified treatment status. We're going to wrestle with this just a little bit, but their implication is that the use of zoledronate in the inpatient setting may help close that osteoporosis treatment gap. So we're going to end thinking about whether this should be changing practice or if we still have some unanswered questions that we would want to get addressed first. So we've talked about the quality of this report overall. I think it does add several pieces of information to our understanding about the impact of fracture liaison services. And so it was a nice addition to the medical literature here, though still with some questions, as these reports always do. But what I want to start to wrestle with is how we can use this information to change our practice or whether we shouldn't yet at this point. So one question that I'll pose, and maybe Amal, I'll start with you thinking about this one. So they talk about this treatment gap. So including, you mentioned this several times, this is that more than 50% of people who were scheduled to follow up in the outpatient setting and then with the goal of treating them at that in that outpatient setting, most of those patients didn't come to that visit. So should we actually be thinking about zoledronate as the default? Do we just need to make this what we do for everybody unless there's a really good reason to not do that? So thoughts on that in particular, Amal?
It's hard to make a straightforward recommendation or a definitive recommendation on this, but I do struggle with models of fracture liaison service that defer treatment into the outpatient visit because, as we see in the study, half of the patients who were scheduled to come to that outpatient visit did not come for different reasons. And that's been an issue with published data on fracture liaison service that evaluate on the inpatient side, but defer treatment to the outpatient side of the practice is that you lose patients, you know, that issue of you capture the fracture initially, but then it drops out of your radar. So when we look at that, part of me does want to advocate for initiating therapy in the inpatient setting. Now, whether you give zoledronic acid or whether you start them on an oral bisphosphonate, but then they leave with a prescription, and hopefully if they leave with a prescription, they might be more likely to continue to take it, and then the primary care physician might be more likely to continue refilling it. Based on those data, I would like to advocate for initiation of therapy right away when we capture the fractures. I started by saying I don't feel comfortable giving a definitive recommendation because there are still some unanswered questions, particularly related to fracture healing.
Yeah, and help us here. So we've got two different things that we're trying to weigh. This helps us a little bit here, but we see if we don't treat on the inpatient side, we're probably going to lose a lot of people. But if we do, then we've got some unknowns about is it really safe and effective to treat on the inpatient side. So we've got that. We don't have an answer yet. This study maybe helps us a little bit, but we've still got some unknowns here. How do you wrestle with that at this current stage?
Well, I think one thing that's a limitation is we don't know how the follow-up was arranged. So I can tell you in my fracture clinic where we tried a model initially in 2005 of evaluating patients in the hospital and started as they did with hip fracture patients because they're the easiest to identify. The patients were not receptive. It was the families were, as I alluded to before. I don't know how they arrange the follow-up. In our fracture clinic, the primary driver is those that are coming to see the orthopedic surgeon. So when we tried the inpatient status and follow-up as an outpatient, something like 95% of the hip fracture patients followed up with the orthopedic surgeon and less than 25% followed up with endocrinology. So then we shifted to a co-clinic where I literally sit in the orthopedic clinic. And when the patient goes into a room, they see the orthopedic surgeon, they don't leave the room, I come in the room. Or if they're running behind, I go in first. And then, so we are truly a team. And there's, again, not enough detail here to say how they arranged it. It may be that similar rate. I don't know the numbers for my own clinic, because I think one of the biggest hurdles in this whole endeavor is it's just very hard to get data, very hard to get numbers. You feel like you're doing the right thing, but you have no idea. You know, we're talking about what's the follow-up a year later. You don't even know how many patients out of the entire pool you've seen. So I think those are some of the factors. I would be strongly in favor, despite what I raised as potential issues with zoledronic acid, as shifting this to an inpatient. The problem is reimbursement for a hip fracture is already, at least in my institution, they tell me a losing proposition. To add another cost is a little bit hard. I think what's really needed and what would really move the needle is quality measures and reimbursement based on quality measures. I can tell you, we can look at the, as a maybe similar system, the follow-up after an MI, where door to balloon time is calculated and reported, where the number of patients leaving the hospital after an MI on a beta blocker is calculated and reported routinely. So I think that those kind of measures will incentivize systems to develop the infrastructure to achieve that because they have to. And it's not that they don't want to do the right thing. It's that they have a lot of things to do and they don't focus on what they don't have to, that's costly. And somehow future revenue or cost savings isn't as attractive as current income generation. So when we're talking in business terms, it all gets a little bit muddied. And then if you have patients who don't have an advocate, who are older and aren't as enthusiastic about treatment anyway, it all gets to be a hard sell.
So, Anne, you write a lot of important things, unanswered questions, things that future studies by yourself or other folks will have to try to answer. I'll maybe wrap things up with one final question for you. And I think this is something that is sometimes raised as a potential limitation of quality improvement systems-based interventions is that out of necessity, they're often relatively inflexible. To maybe say it negatively, it can be a bit too much one size fits all. So how do we think about, say, treatment that maybe if we're saying, well, we want to make Zoledronate the default, you get it as an inpatient, that's what we're going to try to do for everybody. How do we maintain flexibility in a system? We haven't talked about anabolic agents. You mentioned them at the very beginning as good treatment options. And we, I'm all pointed this out already. A lot of these people are coming in with repeated fractures, which depending upon the type of fracture they're having, that's going to be raise the question of, do they actually need anabolic therapy if they're coming in with not a first, but a second or maybe additional fracture. So how do you think about that? If we're going to create a system here, how do we keep in it that flexibility to where we can say use anabolics if they seem to be indicated for individual patients that we see?
I think that's where then it becomes an expert opinion, and that's hard. I mean, maybe the best model is a dose of romosozumab in the hospital. It's a bone building agent. They come back 4 to 6 weeks later, you give them a second dose, or you give them the Zoledronic. We don't know. When I raise the issue about fracture healing, that's what I hear from the orthopedic colleagues. And I think most endocrinologists and osteoporosis experts know that patients break bones on denosumab, on Alendronate, on these agents all the time and seem to heal. So, you know, it's a theoretical concern not answered by this study, but I think most of us would feel comfortable with that. But yeah, we don't know the exact sequence, and anabolic agents have the benefit of maybe accelerating fracture healing. And maybe if we had outcomes like increasing mobility faster because pain is less, you know, there are a lot of potential upsides to that, but they are expensive medications. And this is a Medicare largely population. And so that gets into cost effectiveness. But I think there's really a lot of opportunity here for further study.
And with that, I would like to thank Amal Shibley-Rahal and Anne Kearns for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.